Good morning, everybody. Officially good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
And we will start. Or good evening for those of you who are in other time zones. I have to do one more thing, which is bring up my notes. That's not hard. Okay.
Are you recording this?
Yes, the recording, that part I did. So far I've recorded 5 minutes of nonsense. But I'll wipe that out before the recording is posted. Okay. So this is a difficult chapter, or two difficult chapters. And, we are at the end of the section on time. We are going into what you could think of as third person or third level of time. So it's not surprising that it's difficult. I think a good way to think about this is that, and I've said something like this before, that Rinpoche is really straining at the limits of language, and in somewhat the same way that you may do in poetry. And I'll have a little more to say about the relationship between the presentation here and various aesthetic manifestations. If you think about writing as, or even language, as being a gesture toward something, language is not experience. Language can gesture toward experience. And if you ask yourself what can language do? Is it limited? Somebody's making noise. Is it limited to just being a gesture toward experience, which is important because if you don't gesture, you can't see it. You're all familiar with the painting, I'm sure, a picture of the Buddha pointing toward the moon with the gloss, the interpretation that when you point toward the moon with your finger, you're supposed to see the moon, not the finger. That's the intention. And I know I've read that dogs can't do that. When you point your finger towards something, they just looked at your finger. Seems reasonable. But you say, okay, language is a gesture, and it's pointing towards something. But language can also be something more. The sense here is if you point towards something, then there's something there that you're pointing at. But that's not really the way we are investigating or activating the TSK vision. It's not the case that there is something there to point at. So the pointing itself can be the what of what's being pointed at, because there really isn't a what. The evocation can be what's being evoked. There's a novel by John Barth in which he uses as a key phrase over and over again, the key to the treasure is the treasure. The language that Rinpoche is using here, you could think of, is already an expression, an evocation of what's being pointed at. Now, for those of you who are in the teacher training program, I would say don't try this on your students unless they have quite a bit of preparation. We have been going at this for about a year and a half now, and of course many of you have a lot of experience with TSK. I think someone coming in fresh to this, new, would just find it too difficult, too challenging, you might say too confusing, although I don't think that's quite the right word. It just wouldn't work. It wouldn't make sense for them. But we are building on everything that's come before, and so what is being described here, there's always a tendency for it to sound sort of abstract or to sound as though, it sounds very nice, but how could we ever possibly activate it? Well, if we stay with the possibility of time presenting itself, and really the whole discussion here is an attempt to show you how time can present itself and what that means in relation to the zero, which is really our theme now, then I think something begins to open. And it begins to open, it seems to me, in a way that's similar to aesthetic expression. And I'm going to want to say something about that. So the beginning of the reading, and we'll do a practice, but it's going to take me a few minutes to set it up. I was thinking today that perhaps we should start with a simple practice. People have recommended this to me before. I don't mean simple, but just start with a short practice, just to let people settle in, and do that before there's any talking. And I think that's a good idea in principle, but especially today, because we were late in starting, I'm not going to do it. But we will do a practice. I just want to set it up. So the very beginning of the chapter talks about the fact that we stay stuck in a vision that is about identity and about objects. Let's look at it. Caught up in the idea of existent things, of outsiders, trapped in the rhythm of time. We make of movement a physical event. We miss the movement that is intrinsic and inherent. So this is a really fundamental point about our ordinary way of understanding that Rinpoche keeps coming back to, because it is so central, that we live in a world of things and events and a subject who experiences them. You could say the subject and the object. You could talk about the bystander and the outsider or outside stander. Many, many ways this gets described. There's a way in which we understand the world, and in that way of understanding the world, we focus all of our energy on identity, on things that have been identified, and on the self, which has its own identity. And when we do that, speaking now in terms of time, we miss the fluidity and the dynamic of time. We miss, you could say, the freedom that time makes available to us. So one way we try to deal with that is to turn to experience. And that's what Rinpoche says. Let's see if I can find it here. Intrinsic and inherent. I don't see it at the moment. But turning to experience, in any event, doesn't really get us out of that picture, because it still relies on the one who's having the experience, the self. And there is what Rinpoche calls here an instant occupancy. So what that, I think what he's referring to here is we make everything fit, you know. There's this kind of hidden occupancy, as he says here, but what we do is turn it into a world that we're familiar with. You know, it's as though you moved from one place to another, but you had all your things with you. So as soon as you got into the new place, you tried to make it look as much like the old place as you could, with whatever improvements. You know, you hang up the same pictures. Arrange the furniture in the same way, and so on. That's the sort of instant occupancy. Or I suppose, I just am thinking of this now, that it's something like chain stores. You know, the reason people like to go to chain stores is they know exactly where everything is, right? They know exactly how it works. If you go into a McDonald's in one place, it's like going into a McDonald's anywhere else, more or less. And that's the kind of instant occupancy, I think, that Rinpoche is talking about. We are always already looking at things in terms of a self who's having a kind of experience. And by doing that, we cover things over. So if you imagine that you move into a new apartment and you set up your furniture the way you like, but when you do, you're missing a view that otherwise would be available. Or perhaps I'm stretching this image a little bit, but like you block off a doorway that leads into a whole other realm, because you're just intent on making things the way they've always been. So people, of course, try to escape this sense of sameness, and they do it in ways like, horror movies. I've always thought horror movies were an interesting example. I don't go to horror movies, and I've always wondered why people do. But my theory about it anyway is that they want to be shocked out of their ordinary, instant occupancy. They want to be thrown into something else. But of course, they want it to be safe. They want it to be sort of a simulation of something that's different. And they want to be able to return to their accustomed, occupied world when all that's done. Or you could talk about extreme sports, for instance, things that are dangerous. That's a little different because sometimes those really are dangerous. But in every case, we're always holding on to a world that has been preoccupied. And someone wrote me a while ago, they had trouble with this concept of occupancy. And here it's very central, the notion between, or the comparison between instant occupancy and hidden occupancy. But you might think of it in terms of another term that Rinpoche likes to use, which is being preoccupied. Everything has been occupied in advance. That's the world that we ordinarily live in. And when we do that, we turn movement into a physical event, as Rinpoche says on this first page of the chapter also. I don't think I'm going to try to say any more about that. But what Rinpoche is pointing towards is the possibility of a movement that is not physical in this sense, that doesn't already presuppose a this and a that, or a from and a to. Right? I think that's what he means by physical here, more than tables and chairs, as opposed to mental events. So we want to find this intrinsic movement, and of course this chapter is called Intrinsic Movement, a movement in which the mind falls silent. So that silence is also a kind of stillness, and our ordinary movement then gives way. But what we discover is this intrinsic movement. He calls it on page 90, he calls it the intimacy, that wasn't last week's reading, but there's a phrase there where he talks about the intimacy, oh, maybe it isn't in last week's reading, is it? Well, it doesn't matter. He talks about the intimacy of the instant. So we're looking for that kind of intimacy. And there's a very interesting phrase on page 90 also, where he talks about, maybe that isn't page 90, I feel like I've got my pages mixed up a little bit, but at a certain place here, he talks about...
Page 93,
yeah, I think I somehow got my page numbers mixed up. Okay. Well, on page 93, page 94 then, I believe it is, he talks about, and if I've got the page number here, forgive me, but it's if I've got it wrong, but he definitely talks about this somewhere, he talks about zero appearing as the gateway to zero. Zero appears as the gateway to zero. Yeah, here it is on page 94 at the bottom. Beginning of the last paragraph. And this is a place where you say, but what in the world could that possibly mean? Right? Zero appearing as the gateway to zero. But sometimes when we use the word poetic, we mean, well, you're trying to say the same thing that you always say, but you want to make it sound pretty. That's not what poetry is about. And here, this phrase is really about something different. About activating this new vision, which is what we're engaged in. So, one way to think about that, zero appears as the gateway to zero, is to say zero is the possibility that in our ordinary arising, we never depart from zero. So when zero appears, it's appearing as ordinary appearance. You could say it appears as the circle of zero, and we'll talk about that maybe a little later. But I think here it's saying whatever appears is zero appearing. But because we understand, and we're being encouraged to understand, that zero is always available, then whatever appears is the gateway to that intimacy, that always availability. Right? So everything is preoccupied. We have this instant occupancy, which guarantees that everything, that we are always preoccupied. But that doesn't mean that we've actually ever departed from zero. The ordinary is the appearing of zero. And so here's a place where I think you could compare this to poetry, but it's not in this case or at this point that I want to come back to that comparison later. But I'm not thinking so much of written poetry, but I'm saying that appearance itself is a kind of poetry. It's its own evocation. Or it's the evocation, you could say, of great time, or of great time and space and knowledge, in its ordinary appearance. Right? So what appears is it evokes its own. Language is difficult here. It engages something beyond what it engages. I see Ken's video here for those of you who. Are looking at people's videos. I saw Ken's face for part of it for a long time, but now I just see a bright light. It's just vanished into a bright light. Oh, there comes Ken. Okay. But that was a good evocation, the bright light, and perhaps that was what you were intending to point to, Ken. Thank you. So that kind of appearing in which zero manifests in ordinary appearance, I think that's what Rinpoche is pointing towards here. Or, of course, since any one formulation is not complete, that's one way of thinking about what he's presenting here. But you might think of that as a kind of aesthetic approach to life, you know, where you're always open to the beauty and the meaning and the power of all that appears. And that's the hidden occupation, what Rinpoche refers to here as the hidden occupation. So that is actually what I would like us to practice with for a few minutes, and it will also be the walkabout practice, because that transformation in which nothing changes but everything is different, or I'm sure there's a nicer, better way to say that, but maybe you get the idea. That kind of transformation, I think, is exactly what Rinpoche is pointing towards. It's an arising that is a gateway to the freedom of great time, the intrinsic freedom that is offered, always being offered. There's a place where Rinpoche makes the connection, I think, between that way of understanding and really using the possibilities that the senses make available. It's on page 95, the second full paragraph. He says, zero as fundamental, and of course that's what we're working with here, zero as fundamental may help in observing the interaction through which intimacy emerges. Seeing the zero nature within appearance, again, that's another formulation of what it is we're looking for here. Seeing the zero nature within appearance develops the active quality of seeing, so that seeing becomes newly available. And then a few lines down from that, he says, simply in allowing sound to hear, that's interesting, he doesn't say we're hearing, simply in allowing sound to hear or seeing to watch, an intelligence of intimacy can present itself. So that's what we want to practice with now. It's activating seeing or hearing. Typically we go to seeing first. As this availability of the zero dimension or the hidden occupancy or the many, many ways in which Rinpoche formulates this, we want to do that within our appearance. And so that's the practice we want to do for a few minutes now, for several minutes. I guess before we do that, let's take a look at what Michael has written here in the chat box. He says, the circle of the eye opens to the circle of a cosmic sphere, each a gateway to the other, the individual never separate from the whole unknowable, but through the arising of a new instance of zero. Well, that's very nice, Michael. Thank you. It's very helpful, I think, to make that connection between the immediacy of our experience and the availability of a whole. So when we do this practice now, we want to be able to do it in a way that we engage the whole. And that doesn't have to mean, of course, the whole of the cosmos with the Milky Way and all of that, because that's not our immediate experience, although perhaps for some people that's very, very alive and present to them. But whatever is alive and present, so surely it will involve at some level the past and the future, because our being here now engages the past and future, and we've looked at that a lot in the past. So surely it would involve the availability of the past and the future. Surely it will also involve our own sense of the one who is here having this experience. That's also a part of the whole. So it's the whole. It's definitely a seeing that is open to the whole, as Michael's suggesting here. And then the other way of saying it that I've been trying to gesture towards is an availability in whatever presents itself, and that could be thoughts or it could be senses or it doesn't matter. Always that hidden occupancy of zero, which gives us a complete freedom, that's available right there. So if we activate that, we really are activating the TSK vision. So let's try that for several minutes now, okay? Okay, well, let's come back together and see. Several people have already...
Those are typos from Hayward.
Right. But
kept sending out before I was finished writing.
Right, okay. So that's fine. But so Hayward and David have some things, a couple of things to say here. Yeah, let me go to those. So Hayward says, skipping down a few typos, it seems that zero is all allowing. Zero is all allowing. Is there a morality regarding allowing everything? Well, that's interesting. Do you mean? Can you? I'm going to speculate about what you mean, but please correct me. Or maybe I should. Well, yeah. In other words, there are moral concerns that come up if we say, "Is everything all right?" You know, is murder all right, and so on. The kinds of objections that people usually make. Is that the kind of moral issue that you're thinking of, Hayward?
Error and violence. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, interesting. So one answer to that question, it seems to me, would be that if you allow everything, and I'm thinking now in terms of your own actions, in other words, would it be all right for you to hurt somebody else? And the answer to that is no. Every situation is complicated, but basically the answer is no, because if there's a complete allowing, then that transcends your own motivations. You know, it transcends the things that isolate you out from the fullness of that allowing, and so then your own motivation is transformed. And your own morality, I guess you could say, is transformed. Now, what about witnessing what other people do that is fundamentally wrong or evil? In a sense, we have no choice but to allow that. That doesn't mean that we have to condone it, approve it, sanction it. And it doesn't mean, there's a sense in which you can say the universe is perfect just the way it is, and there's a sense in which you can say wrongs demand righting. You know, that those two statements don't seem to me to be inconsistent, really. But of course, this is a big topic, and I don't know that my little speculations right now help. But that would be my comment. Okay, David says, I look up from my computer, I take a breath, I unfocus, I unclench attention. I like that term, I unclench attention. Open apertures of my senses, feel the newness of now. Specific attention lets go as expansion happens. The non-specific arisings keep space roomy as fullness of body-mind arises, well-being abounds. Abound is also a nice word. I think a lot of times truth is more in the verbs than in the nouns. Unclenching and abounding are both very nice terms to point towards toward the possibility here, toward this sort of gateway possibility of zero that is described in this chapter. And I think it's also helpful what you say about non-specific arisings, because I think that the openness of zero as available in every appearance means that every appearance in its specificity can manifest that zero, but there has to be a way of letting go of the commitment to the authenticity. So it's going toward the momentum of time or the aliveness of time and the openness and allowing of space. within whatever appears, without having to push away or break apart or blow up what appears, but within what appears, it's there. And yet the commitment is not to the specifics, not to the identity. So the identity is always an identifying, and that's ongoing. I think these are the kinds of distinctions we've been playing with, or exploring is a better word, for a while, so I'm not going to try to say more than that now. Eliana writes, it makes sense to me when the mind falls silent and the sense of space grows without barriers, working as a gateway to zero, allowing me to choose between the known substance and the unknown space to choose being. Well, that's very lovely. We choose in a way that doesn't mean rejecting, I suppose you have to say, to choose between the known substance and the unknown space to choose being. So within that known substance, there is always the unknown space, and within every appearance, there is the zero that is the ground of that appearance. John says, I am seeing and feeling that zero is enough. Zero is more than enough. Zero does not require ongoing story or narrative. I can rest and act in zero as the center of vitality and even experience. Yeah, that's good. That's what we're... I think that is what's being suggested. And again, and maybe I'm saying this too often, but zero doesn't require anything. Zero remains zero. You can't add to zero. But although it doesn't require anything, it also doesn't require the dismissal of anything. So when you say, John, it doesn't require ongoing story or narrative. Nonetheless, you can engage in narrative, and as you say, you can act in zero as the center. That's where we'd like to be able to be. Okay. Michael writes, my son walked by and I thought that we are both branches on a tree of life. Each branch is a growing forth from the zero of our own branch. Okay. This unfolding of each zero naturally produces a spreading out between branches as if intimacy is weakened over time, yet there remains the zero of the trunk, making all that exists a familiarity, you write here, of arisings. I'm not sure if you meant to write that, or if that's just a play on family and familiarity, but I think it works as a word, a familiarity. It's not an English word, for those of you wondering. Family. Okay, Michael meant to write family. We can play a little. A familiarity is quite nice. Making all that exists a family of arisings. And of course, one obvious comment, I suppose, is that, to make the distinction between the trunk and the branches is in some ways artificial. And yet to us it matters. If we're up out there on one branch, and as you say, here's another branch, and there's a certain relationship between them, all of that and the fact that it matters to us is a part of appearance. And all of that can appear without zero becoming, being compromised. It's not as though zero turns into one and then many. It stays zero, but whether it manifests as one or as many, as long as it's or from within the zeroness of zero, the zero arising of zero, zero as a gateway to zero, all of that is it's operating at a level that doesn't need to interfere with the vision. And so we're looking right now, and have been for the last couple of weeks, at zero in a temporal dimension, its arising dimension. Of course, you could do the same kind of analysis. Analysis isn't really the right word. You could let zero appear and with a greater sense of the space dimension. I'm not going to try to go farther with that. Okay, great. So let me say a little bit more about the aesthetic dimension here as a way of opening into that. We've already talked about this phrase that Rinpoche uses about seeing becoming newly available. And there's a place on page 96 where Rinpoche actually specifically compares that to a work of art. It's at the end of the first full paragraph. He says, let me read the whole paragraph. He says, "We touch the intimacy of being without exclusion when we reach for old ways of seeing and find to our surprise that a new familiarity," that's the familiarity, right? "The new familiarity with the seen has developed. In such moments, we sense a free body of space available to the rhythm of time, an act of giving without a patron, a work of art without creation by an artist." So an act of giving without a patron, many of you will recognize that as an image that's used a lot in Mahayana Buddhist texts, giving without a giver or something that's given or someone who receives. But I don't think those texts talk in terms of works of art. But here Rinpoche does. A work of art without creation by an artist. So what appears as a work of art. And that raises a lot of interesting questions, which I can't really go into now, about the role of a work of art. And I can't go into them. I had some thoughts about that, but I can't go into them. Maybe in what I write for next week, I'll say something. I think it is worth mentioning, and this goes back to the point that Hayward raised, there's an ethical dimension to this too. It's not just aesthetic. And some of you may know more about the writings of Kierkegaard than I do. I know actually very little. But he makes a very strong distinction between two different modes of being, the aesthetic and the ethical. And he chooses the ethical. But, I think it's important to understand that in this way of letting zero manifest and seeing appearance, perhaps, or engaging appearance as art, that cannot exclude the ethical. So I won't try to say more about that either. There's a lot that I had in mind to say, but we're just about out of time. Let me read you again, and maybe we'll end with this, the second half of the third paragraph on page 96, where Rinpoche is talking about the allowing of zero, and how it doesn't establish anything, right? He says, tracing out zero, we find that the wholeness of time, space, and knowledge together cannot be said to exist, for existence cannot determine its structure. There is a structure, but it's an indeterminate structure. As a way of inquiry, it is available to whoever, whatever, whenever, and wherever. It is active everywhere and all the way. It is fully dynamic in the sense of being able. True to the originating power of zero, it claims no status. Open to all, its power cannot be diminished. So these are poetic ways of phrasing, and I think it's very helpful, actually, to read, when we're working with passages like this or whole chapters like this, to read them as a kind of poetry. I know for some people that's not helpful, and for other people it's obvious. but maybe somewhere in between, there's some truth there. And I'll say one thing about that, and then we'll stop. Rinpoche says here, let's see, well, there's a couple of places. Let's look on the at the beginning of the second full paragraph on that page. He talks about the circle of zero, and he says, this is the circle of zero as fullness, not a closing curve that arcs in accord with a specific rhythm, but an invariable whole that is all-encompassing. Well, that sense of zero, the circle of zero, Rinpoche plays with that here and there in various places. When I was reading that, or when I read that in preparation for this class, I thought about the a kind of poetry that is called concrete poetry, where the form of the words on the page are an inseparable aspect of the poem. And this is a very simple example of that, but because it's so simple, it's also very profound. The form of the zero is also an expression of the meaning of zero. And I think taking that as a clue, you could actually look at a lot of what Rinpoche writes in this chapter, the section I just read on page 96, or the paragraph right below that. You could really kind of work those through and try to find the relationships that are being expressed through the language, and let the language lead you back towards zero. Okay, Michael writes something, and we'll end with that. He says, an ethical imperative to honor the whole? Question mark. Otherwise, a theft of the freely given is attempted for self-gain by a part pretending to be at a center that doesn't exist, except as a zero from which all arises. Well, I think that's all very nicely put. And yes, I think an ethical imperative to honor the whole. And in a way, it seems to me that if you connect to this, the wholeness of zero that we've been exploring here, it's not just a question of an imperative in the sense that you're required to do something. It's a kind of inescapability. The zero is the whole, and you engage that. In the transition for next week, I'm actually going to point you towards a short story that I kind of stumbled upon a couple of days ago that I think is very good on all of this. It doesn't... not by someone who studied TSK, but it's by someone who's very thoughtful on all this and on the relationship between language and the whole. I'll give you a reference to that in the transition for this week. You'd have to go out and buy it on Kindle. It costs $9 or something, so you might want to consider. I mean, it's a book of short stories, so the other short stories seem to be very good also, but I'll point you toward that. Okay. Well, I think we're done for today. No, we're not quite. Sudhi sneaks in under the wire with her comments. Space is accommodating without any moral implications. Yeah, right. And yet at the same time, I think it makes people uncomfortable if you say, oh, but morality doesn't matter. There are no moral implications.